Welcome to the Hobby of a Lifestyle podcast, a show that looks at how our passions impact lives and drive career choices. I'm Andy Gray, a former national and world champion kickboxer. During my shows, I'll be talking with athletes, coaches, fans and more as I delve into their world to find out what inspired them on their journey. Welcome to Hobby of a Lifestyle. Thank you for continued support and messages that you send through. It really is great to hear your thoughts on the show. Please send me a message via the website or through social media if there is a particular sport or discipline you'd like me to cover. I'll do my best to try and make that happen. Anyway, getting on to this week's guest. Without giving away his hobby, I am joined by 2-time Caribbean champion, the owner and founder of the JT Pro Centre on Union Island and the creator of Jesus Walk, Mr. Jeremy Trunay. Good afternoon, Jeremy. Thank you very much for coming on Hobby of a Lifestyle today. How are you?
I'm good, thank you. Living the life in paradise.
Yeah, I mean, it's obviously dark here in the UK at the moment. It's 8:05 in the evening, and it's, 4 o'clock over there where you are? 3 o'clock?
Yes, exactly, yeah. 4 p.m. So, yeah, It's still sunny out there and windy, so can't complain.
Fantastic. Obviously, the wind plays a big factor in what you do. So do you just want to tell listeners, Jeremy, what your profession / passion is?
So basically, I am a professional kitesurfer. I started that at the very beginning of the sport, like maybe a little over 20 years ago, but professionally, maybe like 15 years ago. And I got the chance to live off kitesurfing. So now I started by traveling the world and just competing and doing videos all around the world. And for the last 8-10 years, I settled down where I am now on Union Island in the Caribbean. Wow. And that's why I do my passion, because now I open my kitesurfing center. So it's a way for me to share the passion and live off kiteboarding and be on the beach every day.
That is absolutely phenomenal. Let's just go to the very beginning then, Jeremy. How does somebody discover kiteboarding, especially when you were saying kitesurfing was, you discovered it when it was very new? How do you even begin to get into that kind of sport? And how did you discover it?
Yeah. Now, the beginning was crazy. It's a bit like, you know, when you have these new sports coming and you always have these crazy people starting it and you're like looking at them saying, what did that guy doing? And you never imagine that it's going to become a big sport like it is now. And so kitesurfing was pretty much that at the beginning, a bunch of crazy guys having fun with very large kites and like windsurf boards or surfboards. And that's pretty much how it started. I was very young. I was like around 12, 13 years old when I started flying kites and getting into it. I got lucky because my uncle, who lives in France, because I'm French as well.
Okay.
He had a sail repair shop where some people used to bring him some of the first kites. He used to fix paragliders as well. Wow. So I remember he used to always play with his kites, and one day he came and he said, you should try one of these. And I was playing on the beach with it and I got hooked right away. So that was a way to harness the power of the wind and have fun on the beach. Wow. And because I grew up on the island of Martinique, which is another Caribbean island, when I was going back to Martinique for my school year, I was bringing these kites and just playing on the beach with it and having makeshift board. And actually at the time, around 1998, there was no internet, and I mean, very few internet connection where I was living. And it was very hard to know what kitesurfing was. So we were actually already jumping on surfboards, getting pulled by the kites, without knowing kitesurfing was a sport at the time.
Yeah.
And little bit by little bit, we saw that some brands were starting to make some kites and boards, and it was actually a sport and some people were doing it. So that's how I got started into trying kitesurfing. It was really makeshift kites at the beginning. And when I turned, I'm going to make it long, but when I turned around 14 years old, around the year 2000, that's when I built my kite. What happened in the kitesurfing world, we at the beginning had makeshift kite, which was ram air kites, like more like paragliders.
Okay.
And they came up, some French guys came up with the invention of an inflatable kite, which allows us to relaunch the kite from the water. So it was making the sport more accessible to people. It was like, finally, you could have a kite, you can fly, and if you crash it in the water, which happens a lot at the beginning, your day is not over. You can just relaunch the kite from the water, and the kite was very stable, very easy to fly. But the problem is that these kites were very, very expensive at the beginning. So I couldn't afford it. I was 14, 13 years old. So I built one from scratch. Yeah. I spent 4 months holiday in my grandmother's sewing machine, and I built my first kite, and that's what got me into the sport at the very beginning.
Wow. And where did you even begin to find the plans of how to make your own kite? Or was it very much you just figured it out yourself?
Yes. It was pretty crazy because there was no plans. But luckily enough, my uncle that had all these kites, because he had the sail repair shop, so people were bringing him broken kites.
Okay.
And at the very beginning, because there was no kite school or anything, people were just trying to figure it out on their own. Basically, people were crashing the kite in the tree and destroying them. So he ended up with some kite that were like, you couldn't fix them.
Right.
So we took that and we took the pattern of it. And all every panel, there's different panel on the kite. And we tried to figure out what to stitch first. And he gave me some instruction. Then he went on his honeymoon. I think he left for 2 months around the world on his honeymoon. And he left me with the sewing machine of my grandmother and like a quick instruction on how to do. And that's how I spent 2 month holiday to just sew the kite from scratch.
Wow. And how did that first kite go? It worked okay.
It worked. It flew very good. And it allowed me to go on the water for the first year and actually do something. And
wow.
That's because of that kite that I got into kitesurfing for real. At the beginning, we were still practicing, but it was nothing compared to what I could do with that kite at the time.
And how hard is it to learn? Especially when you're that young as well, I suppose, and you have no school to teach you. How hard is it to learn the control and the whole mechanism of the kite?
So at the time, it was easy and hard. So the flying of the kite part was easy because I always flew kites since I was young. So when you're young, you kind of learn it fast and it's the same.
Yeah.
So we figured it out pretty fast. That was when I was young. Getting on the water, I mean, if you would compare it to now, where now I have someone coming in my kite school and we teach them in 3 hours, they get up on the board and they ride. At the time, you'd need 1 to 2 years to do we do in 3 hours now, because the equipment was not the same and we were struggling and we didn't know what to do. We just had to figure it out on our own. So it was very hard. And that's what we say now. If someone wants to learn kites, I think you should never learn on your own because you could kill yourself. I mean, it's very dangerous. Well,
yeah, I mean, that is probably where I'm going with that. What are your family saying when you're teaching yourself at 13? I mean, don't get me wrong, as a kid, 13, 14 year old, my parents didn't know everything I was doing. You know, I was out and about with my friends. But, you know, you're teaching yourself a very, very difficult skill and you're doing it on the sea as well.
The thing is, I used to spend every single day on the sea with surfing, diving, free diving, and all kind of sports. So I was always in the water. So I was kind of born in the water. So whatever we were using in the water, and kitesurfing was not a sport at the time. People didn't know what we were doing. We were kind of making it up as we go along. So there was not that notion of there is a risk or there's something. They're just playing with a kite on the beach, you know? It's like, so you don't really think about it. And you have these surfboards with you and you try. And what you end up doing is maybe coming home late because you had the kite crashing far at sea and you had to swim back, which doesn't happen anymore. Now you would always find a way to come back.
Yeah,
it was pretty dangerous and pretty scary. But we were taking it easy because it was new and we were figuring it out on our own. We didn't want to take more risk than we could handle. So it was a little crazy at the time. When I think about it, it's like, it's what we did at the time.
To start,
we do not recommend it to anyone.
No, I can imagine. So, you know, you're 14 years old. You've made your first kite yourself. You're teaching yourself and you're using surfboards and whatnot. It sounds very much the kite was the primary focus initially. When was it when you decided to look at the board you were standing on to get more air or do more tricks?
The first boards we were using, I remember, before that inflatable kite that I got, we used to go to some local fishermen that used to find very big windsurf board that they used to put their net out.
Right.
So I remember we went to a local fisherman one time and we said, can we buy that board for you because we want to try our kite? So basically our first kite board was like a 2 meter long windsurf board, like a boat.
Right.
Didn't really make any sense. After that, I got when I built my kite in the south of France, where I used to go for the summer holiday, my uncle had a friend which was very big into the beginning of kitesurfing in France, and he was a board shaper.
Right.
And what I used to do with him, because I was we were like maybe 3 or 4 young people in France, and maybe in the world we were like 10 young people. I was getting into kitesurfing at the time. Because in the competition, we were like 3 or 4 under 18 years old and everybody else was like 35 to older because it was a sport that you needed money to get started at the time.
Yeah, of course.
So that guy who was a shaper, he had some guy that were getting into kitesurfing that were breaking boards. And when they were breaking a board, he was kind of fixing it a little bit and giving it to me. So my first board was one of these boards. He was like feeling sorry for me. It's okay, here's that board. It was like basically a surfboard, a big size surfboard, which we don't really use anymore now unless you go in the waves. And so that was like the first year. But the second year, I got another board, which were how the board was evolving. We ended up using more like a wakeboard type of board, like a snowboard, where you can go both ways. So it didn't have only one direction. It was not a directional board. It was like a wakeboard type of board. And that's what opened up a lot of possibilities into tricks, because we had something very light under the feet. You could jump to the rotation. You could land either way. It was very easy. And that's what launched kitesurfing to what it is now. So I got that board like a year after from the same guy. He's a guy had the board Radical. I remember the brand. And he was a shaper of boards, because there was no brands building board at the time. You had to go to a shaper to get a board. You couldn't buy a factory board.
That's amazing. And when you're talking about this, so you're hooked on this sport now. You're doing kite surfing all the time. It's something that you absolutely love as a teenager. When did competitions begin, or when did they begin for you?
So a couple of years after my progression, so around 2002, I started getting a very good level where I could compete. And I remember my first ever competition, I had this makeshift kite still, you know, like I didn't really have good equipment. I went out there, I was ready, and I had a chance to win. And the scary part, I was like 15 at the time. The scary part was that I was competing against these guys I was looking up to that were all twice my age. And at the time, now it's the opposite, you know, now in the world competition, everybody is like under 18. But at the time, there was no one under 18 competing. And I was competing against this 40-year-old guy that were very good. But I knew I had a chance. So I remember getting ready. It was first regional competition. Like at the time in Martinique and in the Caribbean, we had a pretty good competition system.
Right.
Like a Caribbean tour, which was, we had people from all over the world coming and doing that tour. So it was a very high-level competition. And I remember going into it. And as I rank, because the freestyle competition, you have a judge and they just judge all the tricks that you do. Yeah. And you have a certain amount of time to do them. And just as they rang the bell to get started with the competition, my kite crashed and ripped in half.
Oh, no.
That was my first ever competition.
Oh, no.
So I hated it. I was like, oh, my God, that was horrible. So I came back on the beach and I think I ended up fixing the kite. Or I don't really remember how I did it. And then the second competition, which was like a month later, I went and did it. And that was my first competition, competing against this big guy, the Caribbean Championship. And I won. And I became first. And that was like, and I was kiting very good in the competition. I was so happy. So that's when I started to realize, oh, there's a trend that I continue with that. Yeah. And little bit by little bit, I got selected to be part, because of this competition, of the French Championship, which was very big at the time as well, because there was not really a lot of world competition.
Yeah.
And after the French Championships, starting to get some good results. And then that's when I started traveling the world and doing world competitions.
So you've entered a tournament, a competition, your second competition, first real competition that you've been able to compete with, a makeshift kite, and you've won. Did that turn a few heads, being a teenager and winning this Caribbean tournament and winning with a makeshift kite? Because I'm assuming people could tell this was a makeshift kite.
Oh, yeah. I was known for that.
What was the reaction? That's amazing to be so talented that you're winning with a makeshift kite. What was the reaction of the competitors?
Oh, people were like laughing at the kite that we were coming to on the beach. And most of them were saying to my dad, come on, buy him a kite, you know.
Yeah.
And my dad, no, we got to make it hard for him. It was more like this, you know, not really helping at all. But he was on the beach with me. But he was not the kind that would say, okay, I'm going to buy him a kite. It's too expensive. Yeah, yeah. So yeah, no, that kite was a problem. And I had some sponsors offering me some stuff when they saw that. So like, we can give him a kite and stuff like that. But the problem is at the time, you could get the kite from the sponsors, but you had to pay it back after 6 months. So you could sell it and get a new one.
Right.
But the risk was that if I break it within 6 months, I still owe the money at the end. And it was a crazy amount of money at the time. So I couldn't even say yes to that. So that was a problem. But then after this competition, when I went on the French Championship, one of the biggest kite brand at the time, it's called Whippika. It was the first brand building kites. They sponsored me some kites. And that's when I got my first kite and I could really start progressing.
Wow. And what was it like to be offered that first sponsorship?
I remember that I got lucky and I got that sponsorship through the guy that was building these boards, because he was affiliated with them. And I remember going, so I didn't get the brand new kite. What I got was like a set of kites or a lot of kites, like 6 or 7 kites, yeah. And which were warranty returns, but like with very small things, you know, like maybe a little design wrong here or something like that. So the kites were perfect. And I remember flying to France for the final of the French championship and being like, I have no kite. So I went there with no kite. And the guy told me, well, we might get some kite for you. Don't worry. And I remember getting into the room and seeing a pile of kites in the middle of the room and not believing, saying, nah, that's not for me. It's not possible. Until I think at the end of the competition, I was like, so what do I do with this? I said, yeah, you keep it. It's yours. I said, no way. So I had that pile of kites when I was dreaming about kite all my life. And at the time, when you start kite surfing, especially for me and at the time because it was new, but I mean, it's very similar to many people. You become addicted to that thing. It's like when you see a wind, you see the branches moving, you can't sleep at night, you're thinking about kites. I mean, it becomes a drug because it's a very good feeling to do that sport. So knowing that I could get these kites was an amazing feeling. I remember I was like, oh my God, it's a dream. It's a dream come true. And I can finally focus on my level and not only on trying to get a kite that's not going to break every time I go out.
Does that, you've won a competition which has been really well respected in the Caribbean. It's a huge competition. People from around the world are coming. And then you go to the French competition that you're talking about, and you get given your first free merchandise that you can now use because somebody's recognized your talent. Is that really where momentum starts and you really start to believe that actually I can forge a career from kitesurfing?
Sorry, can you repeat that last part? I got another call while you were saying that.
Yeah, of course. Sorry. Do you know, you've won the Caribbean tournament. You've won the Caribbean competition. You've went over to France for another world-renowned tournament. But when you get that endorsement from a sponsor, somebody who's recognized your talent, is that when you start looking at kitesurfing as a real possibility to become a profession rather than just a hobby where you travel to go and compete?
Basically, I don't think it was at that time exactly. I saw it as, okay, it's something that I get recognized for, but not as I could make my life out of it, only because it's too young of a sport at the time.
Okay.
So there's not enough money into the circuit and everything, and not enough sponsors to be something big enough so you can make it. And it's still not, very few. Most of the pro kiters now, I mean, I would say 90% of them or even more are people that have personal funding to fund them. So usually their parents or some family or someone.
Of course.
Very few kiters even get a sponsorship that allow them to travel the world. They would first need to prove the world that they are good with their personal funding.
Of course.
And then from that point, they would get the funding from the sponsors because they made their proof already.
Yeah.
So it was really pretty much like this already.
Yeah, I mean, in the UK, it's very similar.
Yeah. So, and on kitesurfing, it's some sports, you can take the risk. And if you have a supporting family financially, that's how a lot of people make it. Then you can have, like in poorer countries, you have guys that can't get that, but they get someone endorsing them. A tourist that came to that beach, so that guy is going to be the best and is supporting them financially. And that's how they become sometime world champion. So it has happened. So it you need that initial money to do it.
Yeah.
With me, it didn't happen until I went to my medical studies after school. That's when I had a choice to make whether to continue medical studies or kitesurf. And I chose kitesurfing instead.
Yeah. And wow. So you're obviously an intelligent man who was going to medical school. And what did your family think when you quit medical school to concentrate on being a pro kite surfer?
So one of the good things is like my parents didn't do any study, both of them. They're like, my dad is very self-taught, and my mother, she did a bit of medical study as well, but she stopped quite early and they just founded a family and my mother stayed home. So they're not really the kind of parent that are like that, but they're also not the parent that would give me a cent. Since I'm 15, I'm doing everything on my own. So I, when I stopped studies, I also left my house and just went working. So I did some small jobs to make enough money. And they were like, do what you want, but we're not going to support you. And I was not planning on that anyway.
Yeah.
So I think the trigger was for me to say, I want to live my life and I want to kite. So what I did, I just left the medical study. I think I worked a couple of months in Martinique to help some guys to make just enough money to take a flight and go to the Dominican Republic, where I would spend like 6 months there. And the good thing about the Dominican Republic at the time, which is still now, was really a mecca for kitesurfing. So anything you wanted to do related to kitesurfing would happen there. And what I did is I became a kitesurf instructor there. So you could do a course for like 10 days, become a kitesurf instructor. And that's my best advice to anyone that wanted to live off kitesurfing, like a pro kiter.
Yeah, of course.
That's the way to do it. You become a kite instructor, which allows you to travel to the best kitesurfing spot around the world,
yeah,
to kite every day and make enough money usually to live where you are and travel. You're not going to put money aside, but you're going to make just enough money to be surrounded by kiting, to be able to train every day, and wow, make enough money to pay off that of the kitesurfing. So that was my first, how I got into the kitesurfing world, yeah, without having a payment every month from sponsors.
Wow. And what sort of countries have you traveled to compete with your kitesurfing?
So when I started competition, so I went to many, many places. But the thing, what happened, I went to my first world competition, I think, was in Turkey. And then I went to Venezuela. That was my second world competition. In France as well, we had one. I mean, we went to many countries. But what happened is, as soon as I started competing, I realized that, unfortunately, it wasn't for me. I wanted to really discover the world. Okay. And when we used to go to some other world competition, they used to pick a spot, which was a spot where the sponsor of the competition was more happy to have the competition at.
Right.
And it ended up being usually a crappy spot with not good wind. And I hated that feeling of having to wait sometimes for a week with no wind on the beach and not, right, being able to discover that country. So what I ended up doing, the same money that they were giving me, because I was passionate with photography and videography at the time, the same budget I was getting from the sponsor to do a competition, I was going to a new spot which had not been discovered much before, make a full magazine coverage for it, a full video for kite videos, and still keeping my level to the competition level. So when I make the video, they're still good enough, which was the beginning of vlogging, I guess, which was how we were doing it at the time.
Yeah, yeah.
So that's how I was doing, and that was giving me and my sponsors a lot more exposure than competing. And that was the best way to do it. And that's how I did it from the very beginning. And that's what really helped me after the competition. So what I did, I just ended up traveling from living in my board bag for maybe 7-8 years, going to one place for 2-3 months at a time, wow, just so I could actually not just spend a hotel for a night, you know, but take monthly rentals and do a full coverage on that place. And then going back to another place and coming up with a full video, some magazine coverage for the sponsors. And that was a very good way to get started with it.
Wow, that is, yeah, that's totally different. It's just amazing to hear that you weren't impressed by the world championships that you were visiting and that you wanted to go off in a different direction. How did you get on at the world championships, just out of interest?
So the first competition, I got some good results. Like I was in the 10th, maybe 10, 15 first at the final ranking.
Right.
But what happened is I had one or two results. Like on the best trick one time, I remember we had a best trick competition, which I should have won. And I came second, right, just from, right, politics. And that, yeah, disgusted, yeah, me. And that I said, okay, never again. And that was, I think, the last one. I think it was in Dominican Republic. I did one, and that kind of result was like, okay, I'm not gonna continue that. And I'm going to just focus on my videos and photos. And that's what, in the end, I was one of the most published kiters for a couple of years, right, because of this. And if you do competition, even if you win, you get a small picture like this in a magazine. But if you go somewhere and do a full feature, you get 10 pages in 10 different magazines. So that was like 100 page for the sponsors, much, much better.
Wow. So kitesurfing's really turning you a bit of an adventurer as well in discovering new spots for kitesurfing.
Oh, yeah, completely. And I remember when I was surfing, I used to surf a lot, and I used to watch movies like The Endless Summer, which was like classic surf movies. And that's what I was, the kind of movies I was watching when I was young, the movies where you go somewhere and you discover a place with a medium of kitesurfing, of surfing at the time. But I did that with kitesurfing. So it was great to just go to some places where they had never seen a kite before and go out, kite, discover some spots, which are now some of the biggest spots. And at the time, we were only a few kiters going there. So that was that the search, you know, like discovering places, making videos and sharing these places, which at the time was a little bit more difficult. You didn't have Instagram and all that. Yeah, you know, you're doing it through kite magazine.
Yeah,
so it
was
a big work. It was like a full-time job to do that.
And do you get young kite surfers now who recognize your work and just thank you for almost being a pioneer of the sport and discovering new spots around the world?
Yes, I think a lot of people that have been for, there is a lot of new kiters every year. So with Instagram now, I'm touching mainly the new kiters. But the one that were there when I started kitesurfing and I was doing all these videos, not a lot of them are on Instagram. They're more on Facebook. You know, they are older guys.
Yeah, of course.
But these people, sometimes they come on holiday here and they just come to, you know what, I've been following your videos for like 10 years, 15 years. And this is funny, you know, because now you get people saying, oh, yeah, I saw your new videos on Instagram that I did last year. But when you get a guy say, I've been following all your trips and all your videos for like 15 years.
Yeah.
That's crazy. That's like, wow, it's cool.
Yeah, that is just the longevity of it. It's absolutely amazing. It's phenomenal. I mean, I remember I was in Cape Verde with my wife and there was an area there called Kite Bay. They called it Kite Bay. And there was hundreds of kites out that day and it was just amazing to watch.
Oh, it's crazy. And it's very funny because one of my first big video project was in Brazil and for a guy that was developing a new place. It's like the opening of a river and he had bought all this land in Brazil and it's called Ilha do Guajiro and it's a very beautiful place, a very strong wind. And we did a big video project and at the time there was no really online videos as much. It was more DVDs.
Yeah.
And it was funny because that guy had money and he really wanted to share. So he hired me to make a video there, one of my kite video there. I did a video at the place and then we distributed the DVDs to all the kitesurf magazine in the world. You buy the kite magazine, boom, you get a free DVD.
Wow.
And that was like 100,000 version of the DVD, which was huge at the time for kitesurfing.
Yeah, wow.
And now today, I mean, the last couple of days, there is a world competition happening in that place, which had nothing when I went there. And now the hotels everywhere, it's like it became that big, big, big place.
Wow. And so have you been invited to the world championships to go... I kind of promoted this place. I was the first person to kitesurf.
I don't think... People don't really remember this, you know, they won't tell you, it's just become so big, the place.
Yeah.
Like, they don't remember who made the first video about the place and stuff like that, but they know, you know. So, no, I wasn't invited, especially now with COVID and everything. It's just too much
of
a...
Course.
And I wasn't the only one going there, but we were the first marketing about that place, and that's what started the whole place.
Wow.
So, yeah, definitely people know and remember, but things move so fast now, you know. And there's so many new videos, new things coming every day. It's not like it used to be where you make a video, people remember. Now you make, there used to be one kite, good kite videos a week or a month coming online. Now you have thousands every day coming online.
Yeah.
So it's very a different way to remember something like the same way.
Wow. Yeah, I still think that it should be in there. The fact that you were the first guy to market that, because I just think it shows the history of the place and just shows the longevity and the development of the sport.
No, it's true. And the guy actually asked me last year to go back and make a new video there, but I don't have the time now with my own kite center here and everything.
Yeah.
So I had to refuse, but it would be actually good to go back and see. But now with COVID and everything, it's a bit more complicated to travel. So I'm going to have to postpone that a little bit.
Yeah. COVID's just unfortunately sent the whole world into almost a whole lockdown, really, isn't it? We can't travel very well. And how's it been for you out there?
So it's been great in the sense that we didn't have to lock down here. We were free every day to do whatever we wanted. The only problem is we depend from tourists coming from overseas. And right now there's no tourists coming. So we have an interest. People want to come and everybody want to visit because it's truly paradise. And everybody that come here want to come back. So we have a lot of returning customers. The problem is we have like a 5 days quarantine for people coming in. And for people coming for like a week, 10 days, it's not worth it.
Yeah, of course. No, that's a shame. And hopefully, fingers crossed, that will sort itself out very soon with vaccines being created and we can all get back to living some sort of new normality.
That would be good.
Tell me about it.
Waiting game right now.
I know. I just want to touch on a little bit because I don't do a lot of research before I speak to guests because I like the conversation to happen organically and I've learned so much about you just from this conversation. But I did watch and read about Jesus walking on water.
Yep.
And I've watched that now a couple of times over and over again because it just looks amazing. Where did the inspiration for that come from? Or were you just literally having fun playing around and it was born?
It, It's a lot of having fun and playing. I like to come up with new trick. I like to have my own original style, which is very different now in the kitesurfing world, and the fact that everybody can watch everybody now.
Yeah.
You get less and less riders having their own style because they get to see other people kiting and copy that, which is not bad. You know, it's good. But you know, at the time when I was starting kitesurfing, like I was saying, we didn't have internet. So we never knew what was going to be in the next season. I remember every time we were training on our island, I was mainly the only one training my tricks for the next world championship or something. We had no clue what it was going to be the next year. So we did going to be this type of trick, this type of trick. We were trying to invent new stuff all the time. Yeah. So the Jesus walk came exactly like this. Like I was doing a lot of board of tricks, which are tricks where you jump in the air, remove the board, put it back on and land. And we had some of the tricks where you were doing the same, but while you change direction, transition tricks. So you jump, remove your board and go back the other way. And then I realized, wow, I'm like actually hovering over the water. I could pretend that I'm running on it. And that's how the trick came to be. It became the Jesus walk. So I just invented that trick, started doing it. And the thing is, it's a very hard trick to do. And very, very few people for the first 10 years did it. I started to do that around 2003, I think.
Wow.
And for the last 10 years, 15 years, I've never seen anyone else do it. No one was really trying to do it. Very, very few people were trying it because it's a kind of a trick that's a funny, fun trick that people don't really dare trying. And the very good kiters are like, yeah, that's too easy. I'm not going to do that. But then if they try, it's too hard. So they were like, no. And now it's become more like an Instagram thing when you do it. And the good thing with that trick is people that do not kite are impressed by it. It's like, wow, what's happening? It's a very fun trick, you know,
and
it's fun. It's like, what's going on here? People are saying, commenting on the video, oh, the water is shallow, it's just running on the shallow water. No, it's really on the water.
Yeah.
So it's a trick that works, and now more and more people are actually doing it. When they see that it brings some views when you post a trick like that, they actually, I know a lot of friends that have been trying it, and they come often here and say, I want to try that trick. I had a friend coming, she's one of the best top girl kiter, her name is Paula, and she stayed here for a few months on Union Island, and she said, I'm not leaving until I learn that trick. And I think 5 days before she left, we got it on tape and she did it. She was so happy. So yeah, it's a trick that it's a bucket list kind of trick now.
Yeah, look, it's amazing, and that must fill you with a great sense of pride to know that you created that trick and now people are trying to emulate your move.
Oh yeah, it's very, very nice. And the thing is funny is like you come up with a trick. I publicized it quite a lot at the beginning with kite magazines and videos and stuff like that. And then you have a guy doing it that you teach him. I remember teaching that guy in Brazil how to do that trick. So when you start seeing other people doing it, it's like you come to a spot, you see the guy do it for the first time. You're like, wow, that's so cool. You know, they're doing my trick.
Yeah.
You feel proud. It's very nice. But you get the other side of it, whereas I think like a couple of years ago, I posted a video of it. Oh, my signature trick, the stuff. And a guy commenting on the bottom saying, no, it's not your trick. It's that guy trick. I've seen it do it before you. And that the guy I taught the trick, you know, I taught that guy to do that trick like a few years before. I said, oh, actually, I taught him how to do it.
That's and amazing.
It's internet, you know, you can't really fight.
Oh, yeah, of course.
But you have to be to make sure people know, you know, like,
yeah, definitely.
Otherwise it kind of gets lost with time and other people doing it. And so it's nice to keep the credit a little bit of, which is now one of the most, I would say one of the coolest kite trick. The Jesus walk is the one that people, if you go kite, people scream, do a Jesus walk. That's the first thing that they ask for you to do.
Oh, yeah, I can imagine it looks so impressive. And it just genuinely looks like somebody's running on water.
Yeah, that's a way to go. And that's what people have been trying to do for a while now.
yeah, it's absolutely fantastic. So you've traveled the world. You've highlighted some of the best spots in the world for kite surfing. What's been your... Where's your number one spot other than Union Island where you've decided to settle down?
So, yeah, Union Island, that would be my first one. And the funny story about Union before I tell you all the spots is I used to travel the world. I came to, because Union Island is close to Martinique where I grew up.
Yeah.
So I used to come to Union Island sailing with some French skipper to help them on the boat. So I fell in love with the place. And when I was traveling and I was living with my board bag, you know, I didn't have a place I could call home. I was just traveling for almost 10 years straight, one place to another, to another, to another. But everywhere I was going, I was comparing it to Union Island. Could I live there? Nah, because I was always looking for another place to live. You know, I was like, I want to live at the most beautiful place I have ever seen. If I find a place and I love it, I'm going to put my suitcase there and live there. And I found many beautiful places around the world, but there's always something missing. I have found some places which are very beautiful, but have a different culture, which didn't fit to what I like, or more strict culture, you know, like in Middle East or something like that. You don't have as much as freedom as you would have in a country like in the Caribbean, for example, or like in Europe. So there was always something, you know, and I was always comparing it to Union Island. And after traveling, I came back to Union because that was a top place that nothing could top. But talking about best spots, there are so many great spots around the world. And the good thing with kitesurfing, because it's a sport that touches so many things. Now we have foiling. We can kite in the waves. We can kite on flat water. We can kite with very, very strong wind, with lighter winds. So each spot around the world is good for something. You were talking about Cape Verde and Sal Island. And that was one of the most beautiful waves that I've seen there. Punta Preta is like a beautiful wave for kiting. Or Indonesia. Indonesia is amazing for the waves. But then for flat water, I love Brazil. Brazil, I used to live half the year in Brazil, and it's amazing because it has strong wind, flat water, very cool culture, very nice people. So the lifestyle is very nice. But I always love the Caribbean for the lifestyle because it's same lifestyle throughout all the Caribbean, even though the islands are different. You know, you have Martinique and all that. But you always have that Caribbean vibe, that reggae, Bob Marley, Yemen kind of vibe, which I grew up with, so I felt more at home here. So that's why I came here. Yeah. And the beauty of the place. The place is amazingly beautiful, blue water, and that's why I chose to do my kite school here.
That is amazing. How did the kite school come about? Was that just because you had traveled the world, you had decided Union Island was where you wanted to settle down and just leave?
There was two things. The first thing was Union Island is the most beautiful, one of the most beautiful places I've seen. I need to settle down. I'm a bit tired of just on traveling, and I want a place where I can just do a business and start making money. Because when you travel the world with sponsors, you have enough to travel and live of it, which is amazing. But after a few years, you're like, okay, I want to start making some money and build something, save up, which you can't when you travel like that. I mean, I couldn't, and it was very tight budget. So you use your money to just have fun and travel, which was great. So that's why I said, okay, I need to settle down and do a business on Union Island. And why Union Island? Because two things. First thing, it's a great place, beautiful, very good lifestyle because the island is very small.
Yeah.
No traffic, nothing. And that's what I love. I don't like traffic jam. I like small villages, very chill, good vibe, and beautiful place with great wind. But the second thing that made me stop here is the fact that it was nothing. There was no other kite school there. They had almost never seen kiting around here. There was very few business, and there was no tourists going to the island. It was very much the beginning of tourists staying on Union Island. There was a lot of people passing by boats, but nobody actually flying to stay on the island. And that's what I wanted to change. I wanted to say, I love doing that here. So anyone that I'm going to be able to bring here is going to love it too. So we can start something. And that's how I decided to do the business there and started it from scratch, really no investment at all. There was a couple of kites, a couple of boards, and all rotten boards to do the safety. And every year, just reinvesting into the school to what it is now, a very large school with a lot of boards and a lot of equipment.
That is amazing. And did a lot of your sponsors who supported you traveling around the world, did a lot of them stay with you and go, okay, Jeremy, you've done this for us. We want to now be part of your business, invest with you, and help make Union Island and your school one of the biggest, most successful kite schools in the world?
So basically, I had a big change with sponsorship. When I had a sponsor called Ocean Rodeo, and it was a small Canadian brand, but they were very supportive during all my years. And I was doing everything for them. I was their marketing guy, whether I was doing videos, ads in the magazine, I was doing the whole marketing for them. So that was my main sponsors. But when I started moving to Union Island, I continued with them a few years. And then they started being not the right way for me. It didn't work out anymore. So I decided to stop with them. And I stopped having sponsors for a year, which allowed me to focus really on the school. And I was a bit fed up with the sponsorship and everything. And I got very lucky. One of my friends was sponsored with the biggest kiteboard, which was North Kiteboarding at the time, and which is now called Duotone Kiteboarding, which is the number one kitesurfing brand. And the good thing with Duotone, and they approached me and they offered me a deal right away. And I accepted it. And it was a very small deal, but I didn't want much. And I didn't want to do too much with them. And now they've been supporting me since the very beginning. They've been shooting all their product videos here. I have this is the best sponsors I could ever dream to have. They are like the most generous sponsors. They're really cool with the equipment. And now I'm working with them to be we are like a fully duotone center as well. So people can come here, test the gear, and we have a lot of top of the line equipment. And because it's a top kiteboarding brand in the world, we do cross promotion a lot. And I mean, if anyone want to get into kitesurfing, don't know what gear to buy, this is a kite to buy, duotone kites. They have so much gear and they're very friendly too. So that was for me, for the kite school, I could not dream of a better partnership with a brand than with duotone.
That is amazing. And how do your family feel now after you've traveled the world, you've been paid to do that, and you've got your own successful kite school? Do your parents say, are they super proud of you now? And do they come out and visit you?
Yeah, they come quite often, like not as often as I wish because it's a bit far. And now they're in France. And with COVID, they couldn't come the last year. They were supposed to come last year. So they try to come every 2 years, I think. And they're very happy, very proud. Yeah, they love it. They're very happy to see what it came to. And like I said, my dad has always been he's a painter. So he's kind of an artist and a traveler. He used to travel a lot. So he's very happy to what it came to. You know, like I bring him fishing because I taught him to kite as well
A
few years back. So now he kites, and when he comes here, I get him to go kiting, and we go fishing together with my boats. So that was a great experience, and very nice to show them what I could have done over these years.
That's amazing. And what are the plans moving forward, Jeremy, with the kite school and with yourself personally?
So the plans I have, I'm a bit in the middle now. I want to open more kite school around the world. But there's more JT Pro centers in some key spots around the world. The only problem with that is that means more work, more stress. When you live on your island, you get to a special lifestyle, which is pretty chill. And more it stress. Works the way it is, you know, like you can get to decide to make more money, but maybe not have the same quality of life. And that's, I'm kind of in the middle with that. But now I'm focusing on making the school a little bit more important with buying property around the school and trying to develop the island with tourism a little bit more. So right now it would be more that expanding, keep on expanding without trying to go too far to make it too stressful as well.
That is absolutely amazing. What would be your one piece of advice to anyone who is, you know, maybe is looking to follow in similar footsteps to you, who wants to get into kiteboarding, who's already in kiteboarding, is maybe struggling with it or doing really well? What would your one piece of advice be?
For someone, is two ways. It could be someone that want to learn to kite and get into kitesurfing. My piece of advice is, as much as you can, choose the right spot. If you can, you know, your next holiday, instead of doing somewhere where there's no wind, pick the next holiday around something kiting related. A nice spot, safe, shallow water, warm water. Because it's a very easy sport to learn, but it's also very hard. That means you have fun during your progression, but if you don't, everybody can learn, but if you don't push yourself through a certain stage of it, you have people that give up and you have people that continue. But everybody can do it. Just how many hours you're going to get to it. Usually in 7-8 hours, everybody's on the board riding both ways, you know? So if you take longer, don't give up. If you really want to do it, keep on pushing. But put everything on your side, which is, as much as you can, a very safe, good school with good reviews. Because honestly, in the kitesurfing world, there are a lot of bad instructors and a lot of bad schools. So make sure you pick something good, have good reviews, and with a good instructor. As much as you can, and don't mind spending extra money by doing it with a private instructor. That's going to save you so much money. Even if it's more expensive per lesson, they're going to be able to correct your mistakes from the very beginning instead of you take bad habits, which can take so much longer, more hours in the end. So as much as you can, private instructor and a nice, safe spot, warm water and everything. That's to learn and to get started. Now, I have a lot of people telling me, okay, I want to get into kitesurfing, but it's expensive. I can't get into it. There's always a way. The other day, there's a guy on Instagram, he messaged me, saying, I want to get into kitesurfing, I don't have money. How can I do it? I say, go to your local kite school if you really want to do it. Go to your local kite school. Offer them free work in exchange for kite lesson. It's your summer holiday or something. They're always overswamped with work. Offer them to rent the harness at the end of the lesson, pack the kite and be on the beach in exchange of a few lessons after hours every day. And the guy did that and now he learned to kite. And it didn't cost him a thing. So there's always a way to do it. And equipment, you can always buy secondhand gear that a brand new kite can cost 2000 US, but you have kite for 300 US secondhand. So, I mean, it's not the limit anymore.
Yeah.
So anyone can get into it. You know, there's always a way to depending on how you want to do it. And you can put a lot of money and make it easier. And if you don't have money, it's going to be a little bit harder, but you can definitely find a way.
I love that. Absolutely love that. Well, Jeremy, you've said the wind's good. I'm sure the weather looks great. I'm going to let you get back to doing some kite surfing. Thank you so much for coming on Hobby of a Lifestyle Day. I'll be sure to put your handles on Instagram, on social media, into the show notes. And thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you for having me. It was really nice discussing a little bit and remembering all this stuff.
Oh, it's been fantastic to listen. I've really, really enjoyed listening to your journey, and I can't wait for the listeners to hear about it as well.
That would be great. I'd like to share the stories like that. So that's cool.
Brilliant. Thanks for joining me for another episode of Hobby of a Lifestyle. I really hope you've enjoyed the show. Please continue to follow us on social media. Keep up to date with what's happening there. You can find us on Instagram at Hobby of a, Facebook, just search for Hobby of a Lifestyle, and also the same on Twitter. And we've got the website www.hobbyofa.com. Please go there, check out what we're doing, leave a review on any of the stations that you listen on. And until next time, stay safe.